Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Air Force is reorganizing its entire space workforce and adding new training programs, all designed to get its personnel ready to operate systems in what the Air Force says is no longer a benign environment. Colonel Dean Snigowski is the Total Force Lead for the Space Mission Force. He spoke with Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu about the changes ahead.
Air Force Space Command, you know, really has a long history of providing, you know, space capabilities, vital to the defense of our nation. The training and skills that sustained our space operations for the last few decades are not the same skills we need today to win in the environment that's contested, degraded, and operationally limited, as we've seen. This is why we're transforming our culture, and really it is a culture change, and I'll speak more to that a little bit later, but Space Mission Force is the answer, and space is no longer a sanctuary where Space Command and our mission partners can operate without interference. In the future, our adversaries who are intent on disrupting or denying access to our space capabilities are going to attempt to oppose risks at a pace we have not yet seen yet, and we got to prepare for it. We've already seen some countries perform live testing of anti-satellite weapons capabilities in removing their own spacecraft. And if they have the ability to destroy their systems, they can destroy ours. The Space Mission Force construct allows us to revamp our crews to better respond to threats in a dynamic environment. And it really is going to help our crews balance experience and training, better support the combatant commander requirements.
Since you teed up the culture piece, let me just ask you to go ahead and expand on that right now. What is the current culture that we have now versus the end state that you're trying to achieve?
Well, our current culture, our operators, our space crew members are really outstanding, top-notch, world-class members of the Air Force. They're more talented and better educated than ever before. They have a thorough knowledge of how the system operates. They can detect and fix anomalies and faults, but they're a little bit lacking in the adversary threats, the different things that can be done to our systems that they need to work around. So we're trying to get them to that point where if they see a fault or an anomaly, that it might not be that fault. It could be adversary action. They might have to work around that threat.
And I'll ask you to get a little bit more specific on that in a second.
Sure,
but we should zoom out for a minute. And why don't you give us some sense of the size of the overall workforce that you're trying to transform here? And since you have the words total force in your duty title, how do the Guard and Reserve play into this construct?
Well, the Guard and Reserve are very instrumental to this because the amount of mission space and a lot of the continuity and expertise reside in the Guard and Reserve as well. A little bit older of a force, a little bit more seasoned, if you will, but they're part of this Space Mission Force implementation as well. They're going to be, shoulder to shoulder working with the REGAF, Regular Air Force crew members, and supporting Space Mission Force as far as from the mission planning standpoint to advanced training to actually operating the system. So they'll be there as part of all mission areas. And a lot of our space forces do have reserve and guard support right now. And so they're going to be part of this endeavor. They're going to bring the adversary actions, that piece, and start reacting and training to be able to fight through that contested, deny, and operation limited environment.
You mentioned earlier that the current culture really isn't that well equipped to deal with that thinking adversary. Is that just a matter of there already being some of those skill sets resident within the Air Force and you just don't have enough capacity in that respect? Or do you have to start from scratch here and build new doctrine, build new training, and create an entirely new concept here?
Not at all. Our, like I said earlier, our operators are fantastic. They just haven't looked through it through that lens before. They were more concerned about operating the system properly, maintaining the health and wellness of the constellations, or if it's a space warning system or a missile warning system, making sure that the system is working properly and providing that primary mission. We're teaching them how to look at it from a different point of view, taking a step back and looking at what the adversaries can do to us, not only terrestrially, but whether it's in space or even cyberspace, to complicate their mission and accomplishing their job. And they're smart and talented individuals on crew, but it's just a different way of looking at the threats that are out there.
as a practical matter, then, what does this actually mean for the for members of space crews in terms of the time that they spend training, the kinds of training that they do, and the dwell time in between those training cycles?
Well, right, so far the 50th Space Wing is the first to implement. They went back to they started SMF back in February. The 21st has implemented part of it this past July, and the 614th and the 460th will transition to Space Mission Force next year. Really not going to change as far as personnel, but the duration of the SMF cycles, as you talked about, right now the 50th is doing 4 month rotation, with the first 4 months being called what is the Space Mission Task Force. Essentially the day-to-day mission of the squadron they're accomplishing. And really what that's trying to do is separate all the extraneous activities that we levy on our crew force as far as admin. Even we try to encourage them not to take leave during those time frames or pursue professional military education. And then when they come to their dwell cycle is really when we start getting that advanced training piece, and we bring that on board, get them into exercise support such as Red Flag, where they can exercise those adversary threats and start looking at, you know, what the bad guys are trying to do to disrupt their mission. Gives them the opportunity to think outside the box and really dive into what the bad guys want to do to us and how to work around that. So it's going to be different for every wing depending on the mission that they support. But right now, 4 months is kind of the on-off, is a template.
Colonel, the white paper talks about one of the objectives of the Space Mission Force being able to deny the capability to freely operate in space if necessary, denying that capability to an adversary. Can you talk a bit more about what that denial approach sort of looks like as you sort through these concepts?
Absolutely. We want to have the ability to utilize our space resources and to operate in a time and a manner that we deem necessary for operational requirements. We want to make sure that the enemy does not dictate when we do things, where we do things, and how we do things. So part of the Space Mission Force is to teach our operators how to maximize the effects that our systems have and to use them at the need and the requirement of the combatant commander to achieve the goals of the mission that they're supporting at that time. Is really what we're looking for there.
This effort seems like it's mostly centered, or most of the implications of it really are on the workforce, but I wonder if this transformation that you've been talking about has any implications for the way the Air Force acquires space-based capabilities or what it acquires.
Well, there really shouldn't be too much as far as acquisitions. We need to invest more in our aggressor and our range support that works directly with our space forces and to train them, to get them better, to become more polished at their craft. But there are some needs for different simulators to integrate into the live virtual constructive environment for exercises. Getting back to what we talked about as far as the faults and anomalies in our space crew members, our systems have got to be able to show the operator that something that might be an anomaly is actually adversary action. And this really goes for our operational system as well as our simulators, so they can differentiate between there's something wrong to there's something wrong because the adversary is trying to do something to us. And that's really probably the biggest acquisition question that is going to arrive from this. The training piece is big, and we are addressing that, you know, robustly. But we need to make sure that our systems are telling us the truth, and the enemy has a vote, and we have to make sure we can detect that and work through that CDO, that's contested, denied, operational limited environment.
Share this story with colleagues. Go to federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Department is changing its policy on collection and retention of privacy-related data about U.S. citizens. That'll mean changes for the way the intelligence community does business. Federal News Radio's Scott Mossione spoke with some experts to find out exactly what this new policy means in practice.
As technology has grown more advanced, the realm of personal privacy has shrunk considerably. We've seen this in the way companies track us on our cell phones, stores log what we buy, and websites save what we look at. But the government is tracking information too, in the name of national security. You might remember the National Security Agency receiving huge backlash for its collection of telephone metadata. But part of that problem has to do with the way technology works. It's hard to parse out cyber information on one threat and not take in information on civilians at the same time. In response to that, the Defense Department is expected to put out a new policy on the collection and usage of data with U.S. persons' information. Here's Terry Roberts, the president of White Hawk Incorporated and an analyst for New America, about why the directive matters in the 21st century.
What is a realistic expectation of privacy in the digital age? And I think that's a conversation we need to have. And I think it's a part of updating this directive is, I think a realistic expectation is that the content of our communications would not be retained unless it's needed for a particular investigation, or you're linked to, right, adversaries of some type. And so that we really don't want retained long term if there's no cause, right? If it was collected either inadvertently or a part of a larger matter, it was found to be unimportant to that analysis or an investigation, then my personal opinion is it shouldn't be held at all, okay? But metadata, and then how long you can hold that metadata, that's really connections, right? Connections of who someone is communicating with. So I think this is a really important discussion, but I think we have to take it in the context of where communications are today, the new dynamic of the digital age.
With so much ambiguity about what constitutes data or how long it can be held, the government says it needs better parameters. Here's Michael Mahar, DOD's senior intelligence oversight official, during a speech in Atlanta earlier this week.
In addition to the information revolution, we've got a myriad of laws and directives that have come out from Congress, from the President, from the Director of National Intelligence, that guide the way we do intelligence in this modern age and reflective of all the changes that I just talked about. So we had to take our policies and make sure that they were consistent with all the other intelligence guidance that we have. And those intelligence guidance are designed to maintain a balance between the imperative to collect the intelligence information that our national decision makers need and that our warfighters need, and balance that against the even more strict imperative to protect and safeguard the privacy and civil liberties of U.S. people.
So what will these new rules mean for employees in the IC community and for the privacy of U.S. citizens? Todd Rosenblum, a senior fellow at the Atlanta Council, seems to think that the rules may end up protecting privacy.
On the policy side, I think it's more protective in many ways, because we were collecting all this stuff anyway, and now we're trying to put a little governance structure around it. Is this leaning a little bit toward more of the privacy protection? I would say it probably is, because every time you have more governance, you're giving greater clarity on the rule set.
What the rules do is define the way data is collected on American citizens. Previously, the United States could collect as much information as it wanted, but it wasn't considered collected unless it was actually used. With the new directive, DOD has certain time limits on how long it can keep the data from the moment it enters the system. Along with the time limits, the policy puts limits on who can assess the data. That's especially important during a time when the intelligence community is trying to share more information between its organizations. Here's Rosenblum again.
The rules are really hard. Each component, for example, of DHS collects under a different predicate. And then there is also then the assumption of privacy can be different per data store. So the idea of sort of doing better at synchronizing the rules of why information is collected, how long it's going to be stored, and who it's going to be shared with is a huge leap forward. But this is never going to be a clean, solvable issue. So, I mean, I think what the Pentagon's doing is a good thing. And it's certainly a lot cleaner within the Pentagon, you know, sharing within military intelligence components. It is gets more complex and less clean when you're talking about the intel entities operating Title 50 bodies, because then there's a whole different culture in the larger intelligence community and different rules about that sharing. So still, I go back to this point, though, that a system as large as DoD having cleaner rules for operating within itself is a good thing.
That's good news for our privacy, but what about our security? And how much harder will this make things for the intelligence community? Robert seems to think the policy can actually help the IC by involving oversight agencies more.
From a national security perspective, we see linkages through what I call first phase analysis of the data. That means that we need to take a deeper look because we believe an adversary is involved. We need to be able to get those authorities, if it involves the court order, if it involves the FISA court. You see, we need to be able to do that very quickly. So I think it's about ensuring that we have the right first phase analysis, the right protocols in place, that we can act very quickly and get the authority to go to the next level down. I think we have that today, but I think further refining that in an updated directive might be valuable. I think, you know, what we always want is also a level of transparency from the standpoint of the process. So you need to have, you know, intel oversight involved in ensuring that the process is done right. You know, someone whose literal job is to audit what is happening, as opposed to someone who is mission-oriented, who sometimes, and I've been a mission person, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. you're so focused on what it is you're trying to accomplish that you're moving very fast. I think, you know, that's the beauty of having intel oversight involved and that whole process and set of regulations is that it's a counterbalance.
Next week, we'll discuss how industry is involved in the new directive, how it can help DoD, and where companies' responsibilities lie. In Washington, Scott Massioni, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Share this story with colleagues. Go to FederalNewsRadio.com/Federal Drive and click Share with Friends. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.